everyone. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. I'm your host, Megan Henry, and today I'm joined by Scott Gertman as my co-host. Hi, Scott. Welcome.
Hello, Megan. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm so glad you decided to join me. I know for everyone listening, I always, whenever I plan these podcasts, I do reach out to people in the firm. I was like, does anyone want to come join me? And, you know, surprisingly, not everyone says yes.
No.
People have some hesitation about joining me for a podcast.
Yes.
But I will say, I think after the fact that I did one with someone else last week, and he's like, I want to come on as many as you'd have me for. So maybe you'll join me again.
Yes. Hopefully I'll feel the same way after. Yes.
Well, today we're joined by Carol Musmecki, who is the claims and risk manager at Elkner Hawkeye. And she's here to talk about really all she sees as a risk manager and how things have changed throughout her career, how she's watched the landscape of risk management change, litigation change, and just how, you know, she does her job, like looking at what risks her team could have and educating them and help avoid it, but also her philosophy on litigation and claims and, you know, how to approach, you know, defense of those things. So, you know, all in the New York boroughs, which is a whole other animal, which that's why I wanted Scott to come on, because that's your bread and butter, really.
Yep.
So with that, let's bring her in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell, with your host, Megan Henry.
Good morning, Carol. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. I'm so happy to have you. You were just telling us in our pre-production talk that you love podcasts, but this is your first time ever being a guest on one. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we dive in, since you shared that little tidbit with us that you love podcasts, what kind of podcasts do you usually listen to?
Okay, well, I guess since this is going to be broadcast, I listen to podcasts about reality shows.
Really?
And there are several teams of people who are really good recapping the shows, and it's very therapeutic, and it makes me laugh. I had a friend who went through a really rough time, and there was nothing that was making her smile or whatever. And I said, you're going to think I'm crazy. Listen to this podcast. And not that that was the cure, but it helped. And she called me a few days later and was like, I see what you get out of it. It's funny and it's absurd and it's wonderful. So my guilty pleasure.
You watch all the reality shows that they talk about?
I used to. I don't as much anymore. Listening to the recaps.
Yes, that's all you need.
Yeah.
I love that because I understand like not having the time to like watch the reality shows, but I think the recaps, they always add nice little funny antidotes to it. Yeah. My daughter listens to some of the, hers isn't so much about reality shows. She listens to someone who podcasts about like silly TikTok videos and she loves it.
Well, when I started listening to podcasts, I was listening to murder podcasts. Mm-hmm. And after a while I was like, this is getting awfully dark. So let me find something. And I did.
Yeah.
From the dark to the silly, but it works.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we all need some sort of guilty pleasure in our lives, you know?
Absolutely.
My guilty pleasure is I have this silly game on my phone, just this family that lives on an island and I have to like grow them crops and make them stones. For me, it's just like, it's just mindless. My family makes fun of me like, oh, you hanging out with your other family now? Because I'm like, well, they need to eat. They need to.
Somebody's got to grow the crops, right?
Yeah. Well, in any event, we aren't here to talk about, well, we could, I guess, talk about guilty pleasures. But we're here to talk about claims and all things claims. You know, Carol, you and I talked, I guess it was like a while ago. It was probably a month ago. And we had a delightful conversation. And I was super excited to bring you on. Also, because you were excited because you're like, I've never been on a podcast. I love listening to them. So I'm so happy to come on to one. But on this podcast, we talk about claims and all things claims. But everyone on here has a different path into how they got into litigation or risk management or claims. And you have a long, long career in risk management. But how did you get into the field? Was it something that you sought out to do or did you kind of fall into it?
It was totally accidental, unplanned. My first job in insurance was for Johnson & Higgins. I had a friend who worked there who got me a job as an assistant account executive. And I got to meet a lot of risk managers. multinational, international. And I thought, that it sounds like the best of both worlds. When you're a broker, mm-hmm. you have people beating you up. When you're an underwriter, you have people beating you up. But if you're the risk manager, you're kind of working with everybody and coordinating that. And it just kind of went from there. I was thinking about this. I never planned any of it, but I was fortunate enough to have opportunities present themselves. And even when I was scared, took that leap. Mm-hmm. And my first job as an assistant risk manager for a big New York City civil GC, and it kind of went from there. And again, I was very fortunate early on. I work with someone who is a mentor. To this day, if I'm stumped or I just can't figure something out, I call her and she always says, "We're going to talk about it, but you know the answer." And someone like that in your life professionally, she's a friend that's family.
Yeah.
We've known each other for 30 years. But to have that kind of mentorship, really, really valuable. And yeah. I guess I did something right. And my reputation preceded me and the opportunities continue to present themselves. And here I am. Even how I wound up here is kind of the fates. I had been working for a company. I was a risk management consultant. I had been at that company for 4 years. I was furloughed in the fall of 2020. Mm-hmm. I thought, no big deal. Have a few months off. I'll start looking in the new year. And a few days before Christmas, this same friend, mentor, called me and said, "I have a client whose risk manager just resigned. Do you want to have a conversation?" Two conversations later, I had an offer letter, and that was 3 years ago.
Wow. I love that you mentioned your mentor, because I do talk about a lot on this, about the importance of mentorship and the role that they play in our careers, but also in career development, but like you said, in friendship too. Like, you could call this mentor of yours and you're using them almost as a sounding board. You don't necessarily need advice, but this is someone you trust that has helped you and guided you throughout your career, that, oh, this is what I'm thinking. What do you think about it? Or you just need that, you need to bounce the idea so you get some feedback as to what you're thinking.
And starting when I did many years ago, I started my careers in the mid 1980s. Some people will share and some people will teach and some people won't. And I feel really fortunate that I found the people who would and that I knew enough to listen and learn.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that you mentor other people now, like younger risk managers who come in?
I really try. And it's funny because coming up when I was a risk manager did everything. They did the policy placement, they did the claims day to day, A to Z. So you had to know everything. Whereas now, if I'm a claims person, I'm just a claims person. So whenever I have come across someone who wants to know more and wants to learn more, I personally would like to know how to do something. I'll delegate it if you know I have to, but I have definitely tried to pay that forward.
Yeah.
What type of qualities do you look for or stood out to you from your mentor that really gravitated for you?
Well, when we met, we clicked as people and talk about fate again. And she wanted to hire me on the spot. She didn't have enough money in the budget. And I said, I can make a lateral move, but I can't make a move for less money. And 3 months later, and this is before cell phones and whatever, my landline rang on a Friday night and it was her. And she said, "I hired someone else. It didn't work out. My boss said, give her whatever she wants to get her here."
That's nice.
Yeah.
So how we even wound up in each other's lives. But from her, there was never a mistake, right? We're doing something. And where I worked with her, we were really building the risk management department. And some things worked and some things didn't. So it was trial and error, but it was like, don't be afraid to try something. Don't be afraid to have an idea and to speak your mind. And that was really valuable. And sometimes when you're the risk manager, you have to interact with everybody else, but especially the project managers, about how the claims impact the profitability of their projects. Mm-hmm. And that was a big one for me. You have to be real with people. Like, I'd like to tell you this claim's going to go away for a little bit of money. The reality is, it's not. And in those days, all of our claims were 240 claims. And to explain that to someone who doesn't get it, But I learned, and I'd like to say that I've had my head handed to me many times in my career, and I'm still here, and my head is still attached.
So, you're obviously doing something right. I think you have to go through the hard to get to the good and to learn and grow. So if you were here to say like, oh, it's been easy the whole ride, you know, I did it right. One, I'd be like, you're lying, Carol.
I'll tell you, it certainly has not been easy, and everything's changed. The underwriting criteria, how insurers handle claims, defense counsel. And I learned this a long time ago, that all of those people have to be part of the team and not just saying the words, but in everyday practice. So if I want to talk to one of my adjusters about a claim that I have issues or questions about, I want defense counsel on the phone too, because I don't want to, we have to all communicate and be on the same page. That's really been of great value. I think, Megan, when we spoke, I had told you about a story of speaking with one of an attorney defending one of our cases, and their firm is not on our panel, and we'll never get any other cases from me.
It's not us.
No, and I basically said, make a motion for summary judgment. We never work there. How many affidavits do you want? And I said, that's my money. And she said, what do you mean? I said, we have a very large retention. And she said to me, oh, I didn't know it was your money. And I was so taken aback. She didn't have any qualms saying that to me.
Yeah.
And if we weren't so far down the road, I'd pull the case and give it to somebody else to get us out. But that, to me, is very disheartening. Okay, you think that you're running the meter on the insurance company, but now you know you're running the meter and it's my company's money.
Right.
Yeah.
Shouldn't really make a difference.
Right.
You should handle the case the right way. Right. Even the fact that that distinction matters tells you kind of what you need to know about that firm.
Absolutely. Is it unrealistic? I know you have to spend money to get out of things, even if you were never, ever there. But, you know, when I look at a legal spend of $60,000 and I'm still in this.
Right.
It's troubling.
Yeah. And especially, I'm sure when you're looking at those types of bills too, and you see entries, and you're like, why are they doing this? If our goal is X, why are we doing Y when Y isn't bringing us to X? What's the point? And we talk about that a lot too. You have to define what you want your end game to be and what works for you and the client, and come up with the game plan. And you don't necessarily need to do everything that you can do. You just need to do what needs to be done to get to where you are looking to get. Of course, things pop up and you have co-defendants who can make things harder and plaintiff's counsel who can make things harder. But just
it shouldn't be a surprise to you. That should all be laid out before these actions are taken. $60,000 later shouldn't be like, oh, and by the way, we still need another 3 depositions and we may not win this motion anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
You see, I might have said a bad word about plaintiff's attorneys, but I won't.
Well, we all know.
Cycle of life.
Yes.
Well, I don't want to get too into it before we talk about first where you are now and what you're doing now, and then we can talk more about your philosophies on risk management. So, like, tell us and our listeners, because they're like, "Who's Carol? What? Where's Carol managing her risk?"
So, I work for a company, Elecnor Hawkeye. Elecnor is actually, the parent company is based in Spain. And for decades, it's a utility contractor. So any way you can think of overhead lines, underground lines, solar power, gas, they've worked all over Europe, Central America, South America for years. And 10 years ago, they wanted to establish a U.S. presence. Hawkeye was a local contractor with great name recognition and great ties to all the local utility companies. So they acquired Hawkeye. They also acquired a company in California. And it's been 10 years of change and growth. It's interesting, though. When I talk to my colleagues in Spain who do insurance, they just shake their heads. And trying to explain loss runs to them, and they were like, we have a $10,000 deductible. I'm like, doesn't exist in our world.
Yeah. Tell us, how is it different? What are the differences that you see?
Nobody sues anybody. Mm-hmm. There isn't a workers' comp statute, right? If you're hurt at work in Spain, your health insurance takes care of it. I don't know if people have disputes and they shake hands and resolve it, but they don't initiate litigation the way that they do here.
Why do you think that is? Is it, do you think it's the infrastructure of their legal system in Spain, or is it a different like mentality of
population? I think it's cultural.
Yeah.
I think it's cultural. It's shocking and it's appalling to them that we get the kind of litigation we do. And listen, sometimes something happens and we did it. You know, my philosophy is if we did it, let's take care of it. Let's do it as quickly as possible, as fairly as possible, and let's move on. They're astonished. Even after 10 years, they're still astonished.
Yeah.
We have a lot of safety committee meetings that end with, well, that's bullshit.
Yeah, we say that a lot here too. Yeah, but...
it's reality.
Yeah.
It's reality.
Yeah. I always notice anytime like I go anywhere in the United States, you fly in and you drive from the airport to whatever hotel, it never fails that you'll see at least 10, 15 personal injury billboard signs like in any place. Like it's just so heavily marketed. So it's just part of the culture. You know, anything happens to you, call 1-800 whoever, and it's all over the place and it just markets like crazy. And that's just, I'm sure that doesn't exist to this extent in Europe, and for their sake, hopefully it doesn't come.
It's a really scary thing because I think when someone initiates a lawsuit, they have no idea the length of time it's going to take. Mm-mm. And whatever number their attorney's giving them at the beginning, that's not going to be the number.
Well,
we have a lot of claims where we see our plaintiffs taking medical advice from non-medical professionals, from their attorneys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a good idea.
That's really problematic. Because
I know we're seeing a dramatic increase in like fusion surgeries and cases that we have within the last number of years than we saw before, because the verdicts are just crazy in New York and the profit motivation is too much. You know, you're telling these plaintiffs who make little to no money that if you let this doctor do this surgery, I'm telling you, your case is going to be worth seven figures. That's hard to turn down. If a surgeon's telling you, don't worry, this is a minor surgery, you're going to be fine. But if you know, if you don't have any surgery, your case is worth five figures. If you do this fusion surgery, you could take your money. You should be set. We used to see it in big, big cases. Now it trip and falls with fusions. It's crazy.
I have trip and fall cases are top of the leaderboard. This lady has had 10 surgeries.
Oh, my God.
And she has a litigation funding loan. Mm.
Right, right.
Also, another, I don't even know if 10 years ago we were dealing with that. And now that's a question I ask pretty quickly, and is there a loan out there that's outstanding? And can we use that to our benefit? A few times we've been able to, but
the thing that I've noticed, though, about the litigation funding loans, I feel like it's more prevalent in that New York market, because I don't see it as much in PA and New Jersey, but New York, I definitely see it a lot. Is that just a New York kind of thing? Like, why do we see it more there?
I think the lawyers work with the doctors. They got to get the doctors paid to do the surgeries. So if there's no insurance that's going to cover the surgery, the plaintiff knows that if he helps them out and gets them a loan on the front end to get the surgery, he's going to get it back on the back end with the value of the case. And everybody gets paid. And on their side, everybody wins. And then you have loan companies that it's basically legalized loan sharking. The interest rates on these are crazy. So if you have a case in the Bronx or Brooklyn that goes 3 years or whatever, by the time you get a trial date, $20,000 loan is now hundreds of thousands of dollars. It makes the case almost impossible to settle because the plaintiff himself is just basically going to take his money and pay back this loan. So then you're really just talking to the attorney about fees, because the plaintiff himself, he's so in debt that it just doesn't matter anymore. It's a big problem in New York, definitely.
You said something interesting about taking the case to the jury. I have not had a case go to a jury in years because a lot of our work is in the boroughs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I going to take my chances with a Queens jury or a Brooklyn jury or a Bronx jury?
It's a big risk. Yeah. Plaintiffs know that.
We've had a lot of success in mediation. It's disturbing because our system is built on it being a level playing field and everybody getting a fair shake.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in the contracting business in New York, you don't. Before put their feet out of the truck in the morning, we're at a disadvantage.
Sure. Well, some of what we're talking about is that what I find is that, and we talk about it in this office all the time, like I see the same surgeons over and over. I know this surgeon is full of what I won't say on this podcast.
Right.
I look at almost it's like a criminal enterprise. But when you put one of these surgeons in front of a jury, the jury doesn't know that. And it's almost impossible in that context to convince them because people still have an innate respect for surgeons.
Right.
So for you to convince a jury that this surgeon is doing this surgery for money, this client is letting someone put hardware in their spine because for money, as a defendant, that's a very, very tough sell. Plus these surgeons who are used by plaintiff attorneys all the time, they're in court all the time.
Yeah.
So they tend to be good testifiers more than they're good surgeons. That's what they're there for. You know, and they have the whole dog and pony show. I'm sure you've seen it, Carol. They put the x-ray up and they show you all the screws and the hardware and they show you everything. And it's paint by numbers for them because they've given the same testimony 100 million times. You know, on cross, you think you're going to come at them with something they haven't heard before, but it's difficult to do that. It's just an uphill battle for defendants. That I don't, it's a problem that we haven't solved yet.
I recently got called for jury duty, which is like, oh.
I'm sure they wouldn't want you.
I got called in on a panel fairly quickly, and I positioned myself so that they would ask me questions quickly.
Right.
And they asked me if I could be fair and impartial, and I said, absolutely not. They said, why not? I said, I'm a risk manager for a large local contractor. Excused. Thank you.
Yeah, no, they're not.
And then, you know, it's awful because I consider myself a fair person.
Sure.
But I couldn't sit and hear one of those civil cases and be impartial.
Right.
But how could you, really? You have too much other knowledge.
Right.
Say if you had an orthopedic surgeon on the jury, they're going to interpret the films themselves. So, you know,
I would love an orthopedic surgeon on the jury.
I know, but like probably never going to make it, you know?
No plaintiff is letting him.
Even if you say you're going to be impartial, you probably just truly, your human nature, you just can't be.
And, you know, I couldn't sit there and mutter things under my breath under this other members of the jury.
Yeah, you'd be in the jury deliberation room being like, let me tell you guys what's really happening here.
What's really happening,
such nonsense.
Yeah. So do you do primarily labor law cases now or trip and falls or what type?
So in my days when I worked for developers doing ground up construction, I worked on the Hudson Yards project on both sides of the street for both different developers. Those, yes, labor law. Now, and it's kind of amazing that we don't get labor law cases, but we don't. We actually, for the nature of the work we do, we don't have a lot of workers' comp claims either. But it's mostly the trip and fall. It's us owing the utility company a defense and indemnity. And sometimes, usually, we had worked there 3 years before.
Right.
Our work was approved.
Right.
Someone tripped and fell. That's, you know, 3 winters. Who else dug up the street?
Right.
Drive down any city street or walk down any city street at your own peril.
Did your company does the paving or do you sub that out?
So it depends. In some areas, in Queens, we do the paving ourselves.
Right.
In Westchester, we sub it out. But it's funny because we've had a few claims to tender to the paving companies.
Right.
And it's like,
Nobody loves picking up.
You have a contract, you have valid insurance. Why are you
spinning your wheels? Yeah.
You and I had talked about this before, too, that some of the challenges that you see is that you have your utility vehicles out there. You have a very large fleet with your name on the side of it. It almost makes you a target. I think you were saying it almost invites suits because people will see, oh, there they are.
I always ask people because maybe this is just whenever I've been in an accident and I've been fortunate to not have been in a bad one, but you know, you take a picture of the plate or whatever. And I always say, what color was the truck? What color was the logo? Did you catch the equipment number? Mm-hmm. The fleet exposure and the litigation as a result of auto. I mean, even just in the 3 years I've been here, if I had 5 accidents, maybe 2 or 3 of them, I got letters of representation. And now it's 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
People are trying to clear the no-fault bar.
Right.
And that's really discouraging. And you're right. We have these really big vehicles. They take longer to stop.
Mm-hmm.
They make very wide turns. We've had some really interesting things happen.
Do they have cameras?
They do. Mm-hmm. They have GPS. They have dash cams.
So that
recently, a lot of the vehicles, the newer vehicles, have driver-facing dash cams, which has become kind of a point of controversy.
So
what does everybody say after an accident, right? Oh, I reach for my phone, or I reach for the coffee, or I took my eyes off the road for 1 second, and then the accident happens. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to use all the technology that's available.
Yeah.
And our insurance company really supports that as well. I think we know what our problems and our trends are. So we're trying to use the information not in a punitive way, but in a constructive way.
But your role, though, is interesting, though, because as the risk manager, you are having to work with, you have a commercial vehicle fleet, you have paving, you have utilities. Your risk assessment is very large as to the different things that you're looking at, right? And what you have to educate your team on is wide. You're not just have commercial vehicles that are traveling. You're not just having a foreman on sites. You're not just having construction. You're multifaceted. So how do you go about educating your team as to mitigate potential risks?
I think both our data that we collect from the vehicles and also our claims data, we have an incredible team of safety professionals. And in my time here, we're not one department, but we sort of function as one because we look at all the data together. You know, the trends are easily identifiable. And they're the people in the field taking the message back to everybody. If you rear-end somebody, even if that person stopped, even if that person stopped on purpose, if you hit them in the rear, it's our claim, and then it's just about damages. And I've gone out several times as well. If you don't do insurance, oh, we have insurance. Well, we have insurance after a really large deductible. So that's all money that's going out the door that's not coming back to the company bottom line. I think the other thing is, and senior management's really gotten behind this, yes, it's frustrating to have claims. It's frustrating to have accidents, but you got to lead with not yelling at them, but what's our purpose? Our purpose is to provide the services we do to the utility companies. But our first obligation is that everybody goes home at the end of the day safe. And I think that's not a message that we communicate enough because, you know, in the blink of an eye, something can happen that changes lives on both sides.
Yeah.
We had an incident. It's almost a year. And I just keep saying to my bosses, we didn't learn from this. Really, it's just devastating. And when I worked on the development side, ground up construction, I mean, they would have posters with pictures of people's kids, their dogs. We want you to go home. Think about what you're doing. If you're not sure, ask for help, those kind of things. And I know that they have so many feet of wire that they have to get under the ground today. Mm-hmm. But just take a minute.
Yeah.
Especially you're driving large trucks.
Yes.
If there's pedestrians involved, it's not going to go well.
When one of those things flips over and slides, it's,
I would say, I think every claim, there's something to learn from that you can use to educate your team with. Because even if there's absolutely no liability, there is something to be learned from each claim. Even if it's like, hey, like you didn't do anything wrong, but we probably could have done X, Y, and Z. So let's maybe implement these best practices moving forward. And that could have avoided this frivolous claim. Maybe it won't, but I feel like there's always something that you can take out of each individual claim.
I think we talk about this a lot with the safety team and the safety committee and our loss control folks at our carrier, influencing human behavior. And I didn't like when they said this, but they're right. And developing that culture takes years. Mm-hmm. So it's not one initiative, it's not two initiatives, it's not a big push for 6 months. It's over and over and over again to make those changes to people's behaviors and just get them. Every fatality that I've ever been involved in, there was a very short period of time, seconds, that if something had gone different, the person wouldn't be gone. And never fails that, you know, when they do the post-claim analysis, that turns out to be the truth.
Now, with the fatality claims or even just catastrophic claims, and I've talked to other guests about this too, is that the impact that has on the individual on your team that may have been part of that incident and working with the after effect for them, in how traumatic it is for them to be involved in something like that. Have you found, you know, with your team that you have some systems in place that help the people on your team if they are unfortunately involved in a catastrophic or a fatal incident while they're on the job?
Yeah, we do. We encourage them to utilize the employee assistance program. We've also, when we've had something happen that affected a crew, brought in outside counselors for people to just talk to. Because I know how I feel when it gets to me and you know, the event has already happened, and how that feels for me. So I think we really try to bear in mind that the people who were there and involved, they need an outlet and they need support.
And I think that's like so important to have those resources available for your team members, because it's traumatic.
You know? Those are the worst cases to handle, I find. Yeah. The rest of it, we're cynical, they're all nonsense. But I had one case with a girl who's at she's at a bowling alley, stupid, one of those someone's looking at someone's boyfriend type dumb arguments. She ends up getting stabbed and dies. And here I am years later, I'm deposing this father about coming into a hospital and finding his daughter. And my head is like swimming. And how do you do that? What am I supposed to ask? Was his daughter a good student? How much money she was getting? You feel it's just the whole process is just terrible. And it's not what we do, what we want to do. And it's like, but you have to get through the questions and what you're asking. But you're sitting there, whether you're adversarial or not, how could you not empathize with a father and what he experienced? And anyone who has children or not have children, you could feel that emotion and what that is. And that those are just absolutely brutal for everyone involved to deal with those type of cases.
You're absolutely right. I still take all of that home with me, which doesn't always help me at home.
No, you gotta try to turn it off.
Sometimes it's hard to it's hard to take it off.
Since you've had so many years experience as a risk manager and in the New York area, like, how have you witnessed things change, like the environment and the litigation environment change over the years, and like from where it is now and where it started?
I think it certainly hasn't gotten better. I think that people who do what I do, we gave up hope a while ago that there would be any meaningful change to the New York labor law and the burden that imposes, right? Every year, we're going to Albany, we're going to talk, we're going to lobby, we're going to this. It's not ever going to change. It just isn't. I think what I've also seen as a shift, and I've learned a lot in my career from claim adjusters, especially in my time here, there's so much more pressure on them, not necessarily to close files, but to keep them moving. And I think claims adjusters have a really difficult job. I think they always have, but I'm finding more now that I'm saying to them, wait, can we stop and can we take a break? And can we take a breath? And what are we not seeing here? Because if you bring me a case and we've established all the facts, we've had the medicals, we did the review, and you need authority to settle, let's have that conversation. But I need to have all those other things done first. So I think the pressure on the adjusters really kind of filters back to the insureds.
Yeah, we talk about this a lot too, is that there's a lot of pressure on adjusters because they have a lot of claims and they have a lot on their plate. And it also flows back to the attorney. As the counsel, we have to understand how much the adjuster has on their plate and to make their lives easier, so they don't have to go asking for things to get the authority that they need. So, I mean, that onus is on us too, to be sure that we're putting before them everything in a very efficient and easy way for them to pull the information that they need to do their job.
I think this was true 20 or 30 years ago. However many files a claims advocate will tell you the adjusters have, they have twice that many, at least. And a good portion of them are serious. They're not just, we pop the sewer line, let's pay this person to put their basement back together kind of thing.
Yeah. So going with that, though, I mean, and it kind of dovetails off what you said earlier about that one case that you have with that defense counsel that you said you no longer will use them. And because we have a lot of attorneys that listen to this podcast, so I mean, they're always looking to hear what the client wants. So what are some things that your outside counsel do for you that you're like, this is best practices, this is what I look for? And on the flip side, what are some things that you see that you're like, if I see this, I just kind of like that example before, like, I do not want, I'm not using that attorney anymore, or I'm going to think twice before assigning them their next file.
So what we've been able to do in negotiations and communication with our insurer is narrow our panel down, because I want those attorneys to know, and it's fine for me to be the go-between, and a lot of times I am. I can get records and I can send records. I want them to be a part of the team so that they can call my project manager. Mm-hmm. And the project manager will know who that is and what the purpose of the call. And I think we've gotten much better at kind of dispelling negative feelings. These guys work for us. And I even say to my guys, when they're deposed or even, you know, depo prep, if anything happens that you're uncomfortable with or you have a problem with, I'd appreciate you letting me know in the feedback. Mm-hmm. I think, and I still have a few old cases that are winding down, but none of those folks have picked up on the fact that they haven't gotten any new work from us in 3 years.
I would think
that's something that would pop up on the radar. But I think just that communication, and you're part of our team, and all of our interests are aligned. It took a little, and I still use our carrier as Travelers. I still use several of their panel counsel because they're really good.
Yeah.
And I start the year off going, okay, what's ready to go? What can we get a discount on? And let's move these, because the longer they hang around, it's not going to get any better.
No, they never do. just more time for more treatment, more surgeries. That's generally the way these things go.
It really is mind-boggling,
right,
to think if I had to have surgery on something, I'd probably go to the 3 best doctors I could find and not ask my attorney.
Yes. Well, that's why you're not a plaintiff. Probably never have been, nor will be.
You know, I have tripped and fallen in my life on the street.
So have I. Yeah. Somehow you didn't tear both knees and two shoulders and herniated disc at that same time.
The goal is to get back up off the ground.
Yes,
so quickly,
right,
so that no one sees you.
No one sees you brush yourself off, right? Yeah.
Well,
that's the norm.
And now in the world of cameras and phones, you want to get yourself up real quick before someone takes a video
that's
of it.
True. You know what? That's also really changed what we do. Once in a while, we have motor vehicle accident and the dash cam might not be working, but our safety guys will go to every store up and down the street.
Right.
And more often than not, they get really good video.
Video is key. It's great. Anytime you can have it.
It takes the subjectivity. And I always say to somebody, accidents happen, it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's not about blame. And I think what you remember after you're in an accident might be different than what actually happened. And the one thing that the video does is it tells the story.
Sure.
And we don't use it to be punitive.
My only regret is in New York, we have to exchange all the videos and surveillance before the deposition. I would always love to just depose the plaintiff, let him tell his story, and then afterwards say, okay, here's your car, here's the video. But they take so much of the fun out of it by not letting us do that. And then the deposition happens, they've seen the video, they can do what they got to do. Or at trial, if you have surveillance video, you have to give it to them first. You can't do the whole, so you could never go shopping, you can't ever walk, you can't do this. Okay, is this you carrying a mattress down the stairs outside of your apartment? Like, that would just be so enjoyable. But
they had a good day, right?
Yeah, exactly. The old good days, bad days, sure. Yeah.
Everything was working. They had a good day.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing with video, too, that's, I think, so important, though, to remember is, even if the video is bad for the defense, mm-hmm, wouldn't you rather know that ahead of the game? Be like,
absolutely.
I saw the video, let's resolve this now. And and the same thing goes with like incident reports and how important they are. Like, even if the incident report is bad, or like whatever happened in there is bad, I want to know that up front. I'd rather know it than there not be an incident report and then you're trying to recreate the wheel. It's helpful.
Yeah. Safety folks dispersed over our geographical area, and there's an online incident reporting system. So as soon as they enter that in, I see it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're able to jump on it, get people's statements. But you're right. All that information at the time it happens is so important because memories fade and mm-hmm. people forget or say they mm-hmm. forgot.
And the people can be influenced, though. You know, it's not even just forgetting. It's like if ideas can be planted and then suddenly that idea grows in your back of your mind and you think it's the reality.
Yeah.
You know, especially if something happened 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, New York, it's a 3-year statute of limitations, right? Yeah. So you could be easily persuaded unknowingly yes. as to the sequence of events.
Yeah. Well, a plaintiff's story is going to be different after he speaks to a lawyer than before.
Yeah. I have the privilege of driving a company vehicle. And every time somebody cuts me off, I say, go ahead, bleep, bleep. I have a dash cam. You don't know that.
Right. Yeah, camera doesn't lie.
I don't drive any differently than when I drive the car that I own. I actually am more aware than driving the company car. We've actually had once or twice the plaintiff said, oh, we have dash cam. And I'm like, yeah, sure, you have dash cam. They did. And it showed our guy was at fault. So yeah. Your point, we don't go anywhere anymore where our actions aren't being captured somehow.
I remember years ago in Philly that the buses had, they were seeing, the SEPTA buses were seeing so many of these fraudulent suits. So they introduced these cameras inside the buses because they would see the buses getting in accidents. So people get on the bus.
Oh, yeah. Get the jump ins. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And now suddenly, you know, they have these cameras at all.
They get 20 lawsuits and there was only 5 people on the bus at the time of the accident. Yeah. Yes.
Back to outside counsel. Are there some things that you see that outside counsel do, though, that are real turnoffs for you?
Obviously, going through the motion to keep the meter running, that's a really big turnoff. Mm-hmm. I think on cases since I've been here, we're dealing with attorneys who absolutely spend the money, but let's not file a motion if we know there's no way it's going to be granted.
Do you need to approve on that? Or do you have your attorneys check with you before they file a motion? Yeah. Or how do you control that?
Yeah. And general counsel is very much involved on those decisions as well. I guess I want them, and I understand everybody's busy. We all have a lot of claims cases. But let's be aggressive. Let's not be complacent. So I think that's my pet peeve, although except for the few files that are still with attorneys who will never get another case. We have that now, and we have that understanding. It took us a little while to get there, but we have it now. Yeah.
So sometimes you use travelers panel counsel, and sometimes you could assign your own. How does it work?
Yeah, we have 5 firms. When we get something new, once the file's set up, the adjuster will call me and ask me who I wanted to go to. We have one firm now that's probably doing a lot of our heaviest lifting in terms of the severity of the case. Although Travelers has a few of those as well.
Well, what I wonder is if those counsel that you're talking about that you will never see it, you know, give a file again to, I wonder if they'll tune into this and be like, huh.
I was just astonished. She didn't know me. She knew she was talking to the client, and it didn't occur to her that saying something like, oh, I didn't know it was your money, was inappropriate.
It's just, it's just so lost in whatever the hell you're thinking that you...
Was it a younger attorney, or were they...
No, somebody who's been practicing for a while.
Yeah, because I can see like a younger associate who's not as familiar with kind of how things work, saying something like that. Like, I certainly early on didn't grasp how all the interrelationships between clients and insureds and you're learning at that point. But if you're experienced.
I cannot wait for this case to be over.
You can't pull it. You have to write it out.
Well, I feel like we're so far down the road.
Right. Start over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, though, something I'm curious about with respect to summary judgment motions, particularly in the boroughs, like, because I practice a lot in Philadelphia, and summary judgment motions, like, you're only going to file it in the best case scenario. Right. And I kind of equate the boroughs to being kind of similar. Is that how you kind of look at it as well? Because it's similar to Philly. Like you can have a really good motion, but as soon as you get an opposition, that judge is going to rubber stamp a denial simply because of an opposition.
Right. And we're very, to your point, we're very particular when we use that. If there's a 10% chance, are we going to go down that road? We're not. This may never happen again. Our sister company in California, which I also help out on from a distance, we just had a motion for summary judgment granted in our favor in a fatality case.
Wow.
And yes. And going in, very experienced defense counsel. She wouldn't even say it was 50-50 when her email came through. And she's a very laid back kind of person. It was all in capital letters.
Yeah, those are fun emails to send. Yeah.
I did a scene from Hamilton in my living room. There's a scene where they all stand on the chairs after the war is won.
So yeah.
We won. I was doing that because it just was the right thing happened.
Yes.
And the facts were judged on the basis of the facts without anything else being.
And it's unfortunate that we're surprised by that, but.
Plaintiff still has some deep pockets in the case.
Yeah.
So at least we're not one of them anymore.
Yeah, I had one recently in Philadelphia that I won, but it was still a chance. And in that one, the plaintiff was precluded from testifying. Like, plaintiff didn't even have a deposition. And I was like, we still could lose. it's possible. Thankfully, the court did decide correctly on that one. But I remember being like, I can't tell you with a slam dunk because it's Philly and you just never know.
There's no guarantees. But when you do win, especially when you have a very large demand and then it comes in your way, those are my absolute favorite. Whether it's a motion or a verdict, when the plaintiffs are just totally unreasonable and then they get nothing, that's really what makes it all worthwhile.
The adjuster on that particular case had been 0-13 2 years.
On motions.
Uh-huh. And I kept saying, you are due, my friend. You are due.
Yeah. Did they appeal it?
There was no opposition.
Oh, no op.
Okay. No op.
Well, that's
defense counsel kept checking with them saying, are you sure?
There's no op. That should be a layup, but you take it.
You never know.
Never know.
You just never know.
Yeah. One more claim that I have to talk to my excess carriers about.
Right.
That makes me happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's even better. You can let them know. It's like, oh, this isn't even coming into your, there's not even a chance of it coming into your layer now. That's great news to spread all around. So we are pretty much out of time, Carol, but I didn't want to close up without asking you this, which I ask pretty much everyone who comes on this podcast, is knowing what you know now and looking back at your career, what advice would you give your younger self?
I think to not be afraid. Again, none of this has been planned. Imagine if I had planned it, but to not be afraid to take the chance, to not be afraid to open your mouth and say something that maybe doesn't make sense, but maybe it does. I think we get so, I don't know if it's one of the good things about getting older. I really don't have a problem speaking my mind. And if people have a problem with what I say, I'm happy to talk about it. We don't have to agree. Just that whole, can I do this? I would totally tell my younger self, yes, you can.
Yeah. Yeah, but sometimes it's scary. Just like you're saying, don't be afraid. But sometimes that fear can get the best of us. And I think a lot of it is like imposter syndrome too. I don't know enough, or I'm not equipped for this, or I'm not as good as so-and-so at this, or just you put that self-doubt in yourself.
Well, but you know what happens, and I have suffered from that. But when you do open your mouth in a room full of people and then you notice everyone's listening, and it's like, okay, I do have something to share.
Yeah,
that I have to say is valuable. And that's a wonderful feeling.
Yes.
Well, I think that's great advice for your younger self and future self too, because everyone is, even at this stage in your career, you're still going to be faced with challenges and doubt. So you should continue to tell us, don't be afraid.
I try not to be.
That's good. It's a good place to be. Well, Carol, thank you so much for joining us. I hope your inaugural podcast experience was a positive one. And hopefully, you know, we can keep talking and maybe you can come back for round two.
That would be awesome. I'd love to talk to you about the risk managers group that we're forming in its infancy, and we're looking to grow its members, and it's a group by risk managers for risk managers. So I'd love to come back and talk about it. that.
Yeah, sure. And we should absolutely do that. But before we go, why don't you share a little bit about what that group is? Because if there's other risk managers who are listening, I'd love for them to be able to look for it and reach out to you about it.
There's an organization called the Long Island Claims Association. And I think what they've found during their tenure is there was a real need to have a group, and there are a lot of professional groups, but to have a group that's just risk managers, where you don't have underwriters, you don't have brokers in the room, you don't have tech companies, people who are going to sell things to you. You just have risk managers who get together. We had our first meeting, have a guest speaker, and then have some time to sit and say, what issues are you dealing with and how are you dealing with them? And it's a little bit group therapy, because mm-hmm. when you're sitting with people who do what you do, they understand the challenges. But we're looking to grow the group organically. And again, not that we don't love our brokers and our underwriters and our attorneys and our tech people. We kind of want to keep it a safe space, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Because a lot of professional organizations have grown so large. And there's so much, you know what, if I need to buy a service, I know where to go. I don't need someone to sit in a meeting with me.
Yeah.
Wait to pitch me. So I think that's what we're trying to accomplish. And I'm president of the group. Not sure how that happened. You know what? I put myself out there.
Yeah.
I wasn't afraid.
Yes.
Somebody's got to take the step, right?
Well, and so now comes the part of learning how to grow the group. And we're on LinkedIn risk manager group. And if you also go to the Long Island Claims Association page, there's a link to us.
Okay. Yeah, I think that we definitely should have you come back on and talk more about it. But I think having a group of a resource that you guys all have similar jobs and you can relate to one another and bounce ideas off each other and learn, hey, why are you doing it this way? What do you think about this? And it helps you do your job better.
That's it, exactly.
And talk about trends too, like trends that other people are seeing that maybe you haven't noticed yet, but you can be ahead of and be prepared for. Because look, risk management, what are you trying to do? Mitigate your risk.
Yeah.
Well, again, Carol, thank you so much for coming on. I truly enjoyed talking with you today. And of course, for everyone listening, if you like what you hear, please like and subscribe to Claims Never Sleep. You can find us on your favorite streaming platform, as well as on YouTube. You can find us at Claims Never Sleep Podcast. So thank you all for tuning in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep Podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell.